There's a little known part of Hollywood that most people are not aware of, known as the audience test preview. The recently released book, Audienceology, reveals this for the first time. Our podcast series, Don't Kill the Messenger, brings this book to life, taking a peek behind the curtain. And now, join author and entertainment research expert, Kevin Getz.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
Rosebud.
What do all of these classic films have in common? Well, I'll tell you. The name Mankiewicz. Whether it's Herman, Tom, Joe, or Don. My guest today is also a Mankiewicz. Ben Mankiewicz. Ben is a television personality, a political commentator, a film critic, and the host of Turner Classic Movies. He is one of the best interviewers in the business. Over the years, he's had long-form conversations with over 200 of the industry's top talents, everyone from Mel Brooks, Sophia Loren, Martin Scorsese, to Quentin Tarantino and Jodie Foster and Robert Redford. He's a contributor to the Peabody and Emmy-winning news magazine CBS News Sunday Morning. He's a podcast host, an award show host. He was bestowed the LA Press Club's Luminary Award for Career Achievement. Oh, my God. No pressure on me today interviewing you. Ben, thanks for being here.
So before we started, Kevin, and we were just chatting out there, and again, we're friends, and I saw your little packet of notes, and you said I prepared. And I was going to say, hey, man, so long as when you introduce me, you don't say television personality, I'm good with anything. And I keep.
Are you kidding me? So, oh, God, I'll re-record
No, we're not re-recording
it. By the time
it.
You hear this,
nope.
It won't even be. No,
it stays. But I mean, it's because I'm going to tell you why. Because I always think that that says lightweight. And I'm going to use a guy's name, and I don't mean to insult him because everybody likes this person. But I don't want to be Mario Lopez. Mario Lopez is actually very good at being Mario Lopez. And he smiles. I don't smile.
You're a Columbia graduate, a four-generation Columbia graduate. Am I right?
Me, my dad, his father, probably just three.
But Josie maybe is sitting in the other room.
She might be four.
And
that's right.
She might be the fourth.
When I applied to Columbia to get in as a undergraduate, right, it was my first choice. They have a section in the application, you know, relatives who've attended Columbia. Oh, and we had to write see attached page. And, you know, one of them has four Academy Awards in 2 years, Joe Mankiewicz, and the other, you know, Herman Mankiewicz. And my father, Frank, was just, you know.
And grandfather Franz.
And his grandfather Franz, I think he just taught at CCNY. I don't think he taught at Columbia. He might have taken a class. I don't know.
And don't forget Don.
And my Academy Award nominated screenwriter, Don Mankiewicz.
For I Want to Live.
I Want to Live, Susan Hayward, right. Who won the Oscar that year. That's right. And if not Tom, then Chris Mankiewicz. I mean, it's long. And I got rejected.
No, you did not.
So I'm going to tell this story.
Wait a minute. You honestly got rejected?
So I got rejected. Given that I come from a family of people who love words, I wasn't great at them. And I didn't know enough of them.
Tell me how you got in.
I was 540, 620. Those were my SAT scores. And those are, they're, I guess, respectable. But given where I went to high school and given what my friends got, I was like, oh, no, this is no good.
Where'd you go to high school?
Georgetown Day School, not Georgetown Prep, not the Brett Kavanaugh School, the one that Ketanji Brown Jackson was on the board of that got her in trouble in the hearings, but it was great. It was a progressive high school in D.C., and it was a school, kindergarten through 12th I went, and it was modeled to be what a public school in D.C. should look like if they'd been integrated at the time when it started. GDS is the best. So I didn't get into Columbia. And then I go to Tufts, and about October, so about 6 weeks into the freshman year at Tufts, my father calls. And my dad always called in the middle of a conversation. Every conversation started with so, as if we'd already been talking. I answer the phone, hello, in my dorm, and he goes, so do you want to go to Columbia? Right? Oh, and let me preface this by saying, we put see attached page for Mankiewicz's, but I would not allow my dad to make a phone call in any way to anyone or use any influence whatsoever to get me in anywhere. So I get rejected. Dad calls in October and he says, so you want to go to Columbia? And I go, I don't know. No, I'm here. Like, it's already happened. I go, what happened? He's like, well, they'd called him and said, we're going to give Joe Mankiewicz, my great uncle, his uncle, the Alexander Hamilton Award, with which they had given, if memory serves me, 9. They don't even give them out. Lou Gehrig has one. It's for a particularly distinguished alumnus. And they wanted to give it to Joe Mankiewicz, a writer-director of All About Eve, Letter to Three Wives, Cleopatra. And they wanted to give him this award. And because my father was another noted alumnus, they thought my dad would sort of emcee the event, present the award to him. And my father goes, oh, that's great that you're giving Joe the award, to the person who called from the president's office. But no, I'm not doing it. Very abrupt. So later the same day, the president of the university, I think it's a guy named Michael Sovereign. I might be wrong then. But he calls and he says, Frank, if there's some issue with you and Joe, we should have checked. I'm sorry that I didn't call personally. Something from my office call. I didn't mean to cause any offense. And my dad goes, what are you talking about? I love Joe. I think it's great that you're giving him the award. And I'm like, oh, I understood that you couldn't do it. He's like, no, I'm not doing it. He's like, oh, I'm confused, Frank. Why aren't you doing it? He goes, because you didn't let my goddamn son in. Right? Just like that.
And so and?
Michael Sovereign says, I can't believe you. Why didn't you call? He goes, I didn't think I had to call. And Michael, the president, says, I'll call you back soon. He calls back the next day. He goes, look, I found Ben's application. It could have fallen left. It could have fallen right. If we'd known this back in the day when this was permitted at colleges or happened regularly.
Nepotism
was – this is why I didn't want my dad to call. If the person who'd been looking at it had known
who
the Mankiewiczes were,
Mankiewicz
right,
name.
Then he would have gotten in. Does he want to come now? Like in the middle of October, like I could have come Monday, and he goes, we'll work out the transfer, the credits, whatever. It'd be easier if he came in January,
someone,
but he can come right
someone
now.
Someone was so fired.
And so anyway, I already chasing a girl at that point, so I didn't go.
So in our country, we don't have kings and queens. Our royalty is Hollywood, and you come from Hollywood royalty, which gives you special privileges and access. Was it always a benefit or was it a bit of a detriment as well?
Overall, unquestionably a benefit. But I didn't know it growing up.
Because you grew up in D.C.
I grew up in D.C. and my dad was a big deal there, but it was – obviously he'd earned it.
Can you just tell us what your dad – because your dad did not go into the movie business.
My father deliberately didn't go in the – if my father had wanted to be a screenwriter, he'd be a very
– Sounds like he was amazingly charming.
Very charming, and he could tell a story and he would have been great. But he thought that was – not a business that made the world a better place. And his father, Herman Mankiewicz, the subject of the movie Mank, was embarrassed to have been a screenwriter, was filled with this sort of self-loathing.
That you know, and Franz never got to see the awards bestowed on Herman or on Joe, right?
But that self-loathing that Herman had came from his father, Franz,
right,
who had been a literature professor in Poland or Germany, wherever
right,
it was.
Wherever the borders
speaking,
were at that
wherever,
time.
Wherever the borders happened to be. So my grandfather thought, you know, if a playwright, that's distinguished. A theater critic is worthy. A great American novel would be worthy. But this popcorn for the masses is beneath serious scholarship. If I could go back in time, that is the thing I'd change about Herman. Like, this matters. This matters, right? And Citizen Kane matters. That's why he wanted his name on it. Anyway, so my father came from a family where the movies were never discussed, even though they lived in Hollywood. And for a time, my grandfather was the highest paid screenwriter in Hollywood and certainly highly respected. But all those parties, the kind of parties you host now, where interesting people come, like, you know that it could be a cliche that it's a Hollywood party. So anyway, my dad comes out. Oh, he was an entertainment lawyer and he hated it. And then when John Kennedy was elected, he literally heard, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And he called everyone he knew in Washington. And eventually that led him to Sarge Shriver, and he became the Peruvian director, first Peru director of the Peace Corps, and then the Latin American director of the Peace Corps in like 1962. And that's where he met Bobby Kennedy. So Latin American director of the Peace Corps, Bobby's press secretary, George McGovern's campaign manager, president of National Public Radio, all of these things. And before that, with the 69th Infantry and beat the Nazis. Like he just – this life was so big.
I read in a piece that you wrote, Ben, that when he died in 2014, he died at 90, but he went too soon.
Oh, yeah,
I was very moved by that.
Yeah, it just felt like it. He was – until he, you know, got sick very suddenly – you know, he was working. I mean,
it's incredible.
Yeah, he was a –
he had all his faculties.
He was also – yeah, totally. And he was also just he was a great father, great father.
And your brother and you share the same
opinion. No,
we both
feel very strongly about our father.
I want to ask you a question about where you most identify, I suppose. Is it more with dad or is it more with your uncle, grandpa, grandma?
No, it's my father.
So in other words, you're not a movie guy. I'm a movie guy in my heart and soul and show business is in my blood. And it's not. Yours actually is, but yet your father went in this different direction. And so you're more your father's son?
Definitely.
Wow.
But no question, I'm more my father's son. And we have both thought that Herman, his father, if he knew what I was doing, he'd be like, so wait a minute, let me understand this. You talk about, and he wouldn't say this with any hostility, mm-hmm, but like, mm-hmm. So you talk about somebody else's movie for like a couple of minutes, And they play that other person, but then you talk a little bit at the end. And you just do that again and again and again. And they pay you for this. And you'd be like, well, this is an amazing job. That's a, never, never, ever give up this job.
Who writes that for you, the intros and outros?
A combination of people. Over time, it's been probably 15 different people. But I spend more time crafting those scripts. But I don't craft them from a blank page. I craft them from a structure that's
been given.
Sure.
And when you make them your own, do you make notes on them and then they put them in the teleprompter for you?
I did. I used to, for Robert also, but when I started for the first 9 or 10 years, I'd write little margins. You see, I mean, lines coming
sure.
up. All
carrots.
This, carrots, all these right down, flip it on the white, turn on the back. Then somebody would somehow read those notes. I used to get a lot of calls. Do you know what you meant here? And I couldn't even read it myself. So then finally I was like, wait a minute, I can do this on a computer.
There's no question in my mind that you have a gravitas, and that if TV personality means anti-gravitas, then you are not a TV personality. You are, in fact, a journalist, and you really inspire a sense of trust. Like so many folks, you said it again in writings that I read about you researching this interview today, that like people revere Turner Classic Movies. It's a love brand, and I'm very much into understanding what that means. In fact, I bought a company, I think I mentioned to you at some point, I bought a company called Coherency, which measures love, love of movies, love of television shows, love of brands. And that love quotient, which is the product that we offer, gives the emotional and the rational sort of a combination, an alchemy. And that is what Turner Classic Movies is.
Right. It is a feeling. It's an emotion. It's an emotional attachment.
It is in our home because my husband is like a huge fan. I'm a okay fan. And the only reason I'm an okay fan is because I like watching movies in their entirety. And Neil could literally turn on Turner Classic Movies and start watching the movie.
Right. 41
and
minutes
he's seen
in.
It, and he's seen it 3 times before.
Right.
And I need to start it, understand it, hear your commentary, hear the – you know.
Yeah.
Robert Osborne was a legend.
Totally. He invented this job.
And you got the second hosting job. How did you get the job?
Ever wondered what it takes to make it in the movie business? Peel back the curtain with 4-6 Success Filmmaking. 4-6 Success Filmmaking is where filmmakers share their stories and the secrets.
It's beyond competitive out there.
There have been movies that it's taken me 10 years to get made.
Don't wait to create. Like, you've got to just keep making stuff.
Tune in to 4-6 Success Filmmaking for your dose of cinematic realness, direct from the voices that have lived it.
Good fortune, luck, and I came out to L.A. I didn't want to be a journalist anymore. I'd been a television reporter.
On camera?
Oh, yeah. And then I got in Columbia Journalism School later, and I told my dad not to call again. But you talked about the privilege of being a Mankiewicz, and there's no question it is. There was a funny moment in when Mank came out, and we did – my brother and I, Josh Mankiewicz, who's a correspondent for Dateline NBC and the best big brother in the history of the world. He's much older,
He's
much older. He's a much older man than I. No, he's 12 years older. So we had an interesting relationship. There's no competition.
But he's not as much of a stud as you are.
Well, that's very nice to say. But he taught me how to be on TV, taught me how to write. He taught me how to tell a story, how to pause.
Wow.
You know, it's everything. Taught me how to shave, taught me how to shampoo my hair, all these things, you know, in addition to how to talk to girls.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's like really cool.
Yeah, it's great.
So how'd you get the job?
So I came out, I auditioned for every job there was. I wanted to be a talk show host,
who
game show host.
Who represented you at that time? For like how does that work?
That was
were you a news
– like Beanstalk, who run by Richard and Carol Liebner, and their son Adam was my agent first. And I just
they represented like news and sports
news,
people?
News people. Totally.
Got it, 100% people.
News people. Yeah. And then I eventually switched to Ken Linder because I had a meeting with him and he was like, you're like a combination of Keith Olbermann and Dennis Miller. And I like couldn't have like, where do I sign? Where do I sign? How do I sign with you? Right. That was, it was like, if we were going to trick me into something, that was how in 2005. I mean, I don't think it's true, but it was very flattering to hear at the time. I went on all these auditions and they're just the worst thing in the world. I mean, you come into a sterile room and they're like, you're the host of this game show. Contestant one is named Josie. Contestant two is named Kevin. And then I explain the rules, while reading off a giant cue card. And the rules are, Kevin, they're baffling. All right, Kevin, the first two questions go to you. You'll have a chance to answer the first question. If you miss it, you can go right to the second question. But if you miss that one, Josie should be ready with
so
a chance to
steal. You did audition to be a TV personality.
Yeah, yes, I did. That's right. And I didn't get any of those jobs. I came close a couple times. I was a finalist for the syndicated version of The Weakest Link, the one that had been hosted by the English woman on primetime. But I didn't get that. I thought of different ways to say the catchphrase was, "You are the weakest link, goodbye." And she would say it with her sort of curt prep school English accent, right? So night before, I learned how to say goodbye in like 8 different languages. And so like I got a big stage, big audition, full show, 30 minutes in there. And, you know, and I go, you know, "You are the weakest link, arrivederci." And they're like, whatever I said, dasvidaniya, whatever. And they're like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Oh, I thought it would say it different." And they're like, "Say it in English.
Stick to the script."
Yeah, say it in English.
Stick to the script.
Yeah, totally. And then the TCM audition process at that point was they were looking for another host to do weekends during the day, where research had shown a lot of people watching movies Saturday and Sunday during the day. Robert did primetime 7 nights a week, Robert Osborne. And they brought me in, and for a brief moment, their plan for the weekends
was— They flew you into Atlanta?
No, it was out here. It was out here. Both auditions were out here. I was with 9 other people, and it was— Their plan was they would have a host, and the host would have a guest or a number of guests, and it would be whether it was a filmmaker or the child of a filmmaker or some relative, some expert, but they wanted to get filmmakers on the air, and it would be in conversation. So they had us watch 7 Samurai and then John Sturges's 1960 remake, The Magnificent Seven, the Western remake of Kurosawa's 7 Samurai. So I watched these movies, and oddly enough, I'd seen 7 Samurai. I had never seen The Magnificent Seven at that point. In the audition would be, they'd bring 3 of us in. 1 of us would be the host. 2 of us would be the guests. And they mix it up. And they kept having me come back. I was like in every setting. And
wow.
I was like, they like me. But think of that. If I'd gone in again and just read on the prompter, I mean, I'd been in news. I could read a teleprompter. It's a strange skill to have, but it doesn't make you smart. But here I was talking to people and engaging in something. And there was time. Like we'd have 10-minute conversations. Nobody was saying, "Okay, great. Thanks for coming in." And walking out of a sterile room, there was give and take, and they used me as the guest, and they kept using me as the host again and again. And I thought, well, I think I've done well in this audition because I could breathe. I learned quickly that I'd made the next round. By the time I came back, and I think maybe 2 or 3 other people, they had abandoned that process because it was going to be way too hard to book, and it was just going to be read a lead in. All I did was come in and read an intro that they had written for the bishop's wife, Cary Grant, Loretta Young, David Niven. And I came in and I read that on a teleprompter in a hotel room in Century City in Los Angeles. And I finish, and the guy who's running it, who left before I started, was like, "Well, this isn't your first this
rodeo."
No, he said barbecue. That's what was strange. I thought rodeo was gone. "This isn't your first barbecue." And then I got the job. And if that had been the luck of having them have this different idea for the first audition is why I got the job. That's what put me in the next round. I don't think I'd have gotten it if I'd just come in and read the first time. So, and that's the luck part. After that audition, I get home. My girlfriend at the time, I say, "Let's turn on the TV. Let's turn on TCM. And if Mankiewicz had anything to do with the movie that's playing right now, I'll get this job after the second audition." We turn it on, and there's Humphrey Bogart. And right away, I'm like, "I think this is the Barefoot Contessa. And I think Joe wrote and directed this movie." And so I don't know. It just felt like I don't believe in stuff like that at all.
Well,
but it was a fun little moment. Yeah.
I guess you've answered the question very clearly that Mankiewicz has primarily been beneficial to you
in
your life. I mean, I kind of knew the answer. When we come back, we're going to talk movies, and I mean specific movies, back in a moment.
Get a glimpse into a secret part of Hollywood that few are aware of and that filmmakers rarely talk about. In the new book, Audienceology, by Kevin Getz. Each chapter is filled with never-before-revealed inside stories and interviews from famous studio chiefs, directors, producers, and movie stars, bringing the art and science of audienceology into focus. Audienceology, how moviegoers shape the films we love. From Tiller Press at Simon & Schuster. Available now.
We're back here with Ben Mankiewicz. Ben, truthfully, do you watch every movie that you intro and outro?
If this were a deposition, the answer would have to be no. Do I watch every movie? Definitely not. Have I seen now
Yeah, that's what it's
almost
really going,
every movie? Yeah. Close. you know.
And I'm not being funny when I ask this. Have you ever convinced yourself to watch a movie because it was really interesting what you were saying?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, totally. I mean,
because you've gotten me interested to watch some movies because of the information you've given me about the movie.
I thought that I knew enough about movies when I got the job. And then it quickly became apparent that I was out of my depth. But I recognized it's like homework if you're into the subject. Like, you can always learn more.
As a head of a research company, I find that I have to be ahead of information because people are going to ask me in interviews, in my company, my clients, they're going to depend on me to know certain things. And you kind of suffer from the same thing.
Totally, because people will come up to me all the time. And we're about to, as we record this, we're shortly before going on a TCM cruise. We've done 10 of them with film festivals. And like, people will come up to me and they have one or maybe two or three favorite movie, and they know everything about this movie. And so they'll be like, you know,
you better at least know the name of the movie.
Yeah. Titles have become a challenge for me to pull quickly. So they'll come in and they're like, I'm a little curious and fill in the blank. Why does Brian Ahern do X? And I'm like, dude, you've seen this movie 12 times and you just saw it.
Do you have any good screening stories that were either told to you by your uncle, your great uncle,
Tom Mankiewicz, my cousin.
Tom.
Yeah. I have to think for a sec. I mean,
there's some really good ones, especially in the golden age of movies when there was not necessarily as much of a codified way of doing what we now do.
Well, my grandfather said the legend is, and these stories are all too good to be true, but that he got fired, I guess, at Columbia by Harry Cohn because, you know, Cohn used to determine in a screening, you know, if his ass got uncomfortable. Right. So Herman is said to have said, you know, oh no, there it is. I can't even remember the line, but you know, he moved his ass. We're doomed. Right.
Yeah, totally. Is there a role that the audience plays in establishing a film as a classic?
Oh, I think the audience probably plays the most important role. I don't know that critics or film scholars alone can really make that happen because the impact has to be emotional. Now, I understand that there are hundreds, thousands of really good movies that never connected with an audience. You know that to be true. It just happens, especially low-budget movies or slightly avant-garde films that probably were never going to find an audience. But I don't really have a good definition of classic, and you ask me tomorrow, it might be different. But to me, it's a movie that over a period of time, probably generations, continues to emotionally move people to the point where they recall the movie, think about the movie, and want to watch it. And mostly it's this feeling that I have of they want to share it. Like when you feel this passionately about a movie over a long period of time and the people who come into your life, you know, you're like, you have to see, you know, you got to see Paths of Glory. You have, to, I got, like I, you know, I just saw three movies this week that many people should have seen, but I know that a number of my friends who care about movies and care about politics probably haven't. And I saw this week, again, all movies I'd seen before. Not fair. Two of them I'd seen before a couple of times. So Battle of Algiers.
Never saw it.
Oh, my God. It's so good. It's a New Republic called it the most significant political film of all time. I put it at number one. And the second one, written by Elia Kazan, the screenplay by Bud Schulberg, A Face in the Crowd.
Which is extraordinary.
Extraordinary.
Andy Griffith delivers a performance in that is – it's just one of the great performances that I've ever seen.
It could have been a respected dramatic actor.
Why do you suppose no one's remade it? I guess you could say Network is kind of that movie in a way.
Network,
right?
Is its 20-year later follow-up, no question, delivering sort of – Patty Chayefsky and Bud Schulberg. Chayefsky wrote Network and Bud Schulberg wrote A Face in the Crowd. I mean, I'm not sure I've ever used the word prescient in a sentence with a friend, but you have to use it when describing these movies. And the third one is the documentary on James Baldwin from 2017 or 18, I Am Not Your Negro, which I wanted to see.
What touched you so much about that? I have to see it.
Prescience, again, because we got all these clips of Baldwin talking about the world we live in various interviews in the 60s and 70s. And it feels like, oh my God, this guy more than anyone else understood where we were headed.
What do you think the most important political film of our generation?
So, I mean, so not counting like Battle of Algiers, like six, which is 66. You mean like,
no,
like in this century?
I'm talking 80s, 90s.
80s, 90s. That would leave out 3 Days of the Condor.
It's kind of a bit of a hard question because political movies usually have to marinate, don't they, to have an importance?
I think so. I think that's right. I mean, there have been obviously some good ones. I mean, like little movies. I mean, like Election is on the list. Alexander Payne's movie, which again, it's a political movie.
I worked on that movie. Yeah. I remember that. That's where I met Alexander. Have you seen his new movie, The Holdovers?
Love it. I think it's just wonderful. It's such a great film.
And especially since you went to a school like, not that, but like a private school, you kind of probably know that vibe.
A little bit. But the private school I went to was really modeled on like, I mean, it was ripped jeans, called teachers by their first name.
Oh, and this is more like Eton.
Yeah. And GDS is not Eton. GDS is more like the school without walls, which, by the way, was a school in Washington. Yeah, that's right.
What did you think of that movie that was, you know, boom, boom?
All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah.
The remake or the new imagination. So I thought, for the first like 30 minutes that I was, I thought, what's happening with the music? Which I never notice in a movie, ever. It's a weakness of mine. Like, but you can't help but note it here. That, and then I got invested. After I finished it, I thought, oh, I think maybe I just saw something
What was
special.
Incredible is they literally made barely any forward movement the entire time they were entrenched.
So I'm going to do you a favor and not spend the next however much we have left talking about the madness of World War One, which I know a lot about.
Okay, so
which
we'll
is why
to do another show about that.
Which is why everyone should see Paths of Glory.
Paths of Glory. I haven't seen Paths of Glory in years. It was too hard to watch.
It's heartbreaking
at that time.
Yeah.
So and same with like Deer Hunter.
Yeah.
Platoon. Those were really hard movies for me to watch. But I'm going to go back and look at it because of your recommendation, which is so much about what we talk about in my book, Audienceology, which is about audience advocacy and passion and evangelism actually means that's the success. It's not trailers. It's not commercials.
That's
yes, those get people aware and interested. But the real selling point of any movie and what defines a classic is that definite recommend, that word of mouth.
Right. And that applies, by the way, coming back to my D.C. roots, that applies to politics, too. You can have as many ads as you want. Some of them are incredibly effective. But, man, when your neighbors start saying, you should look at this guy, when your friends start saying, this is a candidate who interests me, that has a very powerful effect on voters.
All right. So I'm going to just play a little here and do a speed round for a moment and just see what comes out.
All right.
I'm going to ask you some favorites. First of all, is Citizen Kane your favorite movie of all time?
No, because it doesn't move me emotionally like other movies. It's brilliant and it's super important and arguably one of the most significant political films, certainly, and it's high on the New Republic's list. But I don't cry during Citizen Kane.
What is the favorite classic movie of all time?
It's either Paths of Glory, Stanley Kubrick's World War One film produced by Kirk Douglas, starring Kirk Douglas. It's the best, it's as good a war movie as you're going to get. It's really a courtroom movie, except Battle of Algiers might be the best war movie, except Saving Private Ryan is the best war movie. So you see my problem with saying best. But so it's either Paths of Glory, which is so moving and difficult to watch in a good way, and then Casablanca. It's the best the studios have ever done.
Well, arguably, the list goes back and forth between Casablanca and Citizen Kane always in the top AFI lists and all of those.
But
lists.
Why I like Casablanca better is because Casablanca never fails to move me. I will cry always.
You just said something that is a absolute paramount importance when we test movies for the emotional and the intellectual satisfaction needing to be there in tandem.
Yeah. And
for the great movies.
That's right.
Right.
They have to be there in tandem. You have to feel it. That's what makes you go back. I feel easily. I cry when Bart is kind to Lisa on The Simpsons. You know, I get choked up. When he stops being a punk.
Wow, you heard it here first. Let me ask you this one. The movie that you watch over and over again.
Oh, my God. So many. I watch Casablanca a lot. I watch Shawshank Redemption a lot.
Good.
And I'm a man in my 50s.
What if you want to laugh?
I watch Anchorman a lot.
The first one.
The first one. The first one is special.
Ron Burgundy.
And my brother, you know, who's been in news all his life, doesn't think it's funny. And it confounds me that my brother doesn't think Anchorman is funny. I'm like, no.
What does he think is funny?
First of all, my brother is hilarious. So that's part of the problem is that he's so funny. I mean, what he thinks is funny.
Can we have a beer or scotch or something some night with him? I'd love to get to know him. He sounds like
he's not going to drink beer or a scotch. But but we can hang out.
What's the most underrated film?
No, most underrated film. Well, there's so many great films. I don't know quite that I'm going to be able to come up with a great answer. I was preparing to do an interview, a long-form interview, a couple hours, with Eli Roth. Right?
He's going to be a guest next week.
I had never seen an Eli Roth movie because they're not my kind of movies. I can watch violence. I cannot watch people who
torture
who know they're going to die being tortured.
Yeah.
I can't do it. And so it's just not my kind of movie. But as soon as I saw the first 20 minutes of his first film, Cabin Fever, which he wrote, you can see that this is a director with a sense of purpose. Even though it's not my kind of movie, I'm like, this is well made.
I really enjoyed working with him.
And then, and he seems really engaging. Like, I already like him, and he's very handsome.
Do you want to see his bar mitzvah picture? I have it here.
No, I would like to see his bar
mitzvah. He sent me, it's in the other room because I left my phone in there, but he sent me the bar mitzvah picture with his buddy who wrote his latest movie, Thanksgiving, with him, and the two of them, like, standing there. And then he sent me another one when they were playing pool. Like, when he was like 13 with the same guy. That's loyalty, man.
When I was screening stuff before, I was watching his scenes in Inglourious Basterds, another movie I love. I like pretty much all Tarantino's movies. And I pause it and I say to my wife, this is the night before I'm supposed to do the interview with Eli. And I'm like, you know, hey, that's Eli Roth. And she was like, that's Eli Roth? He's got to be America's most handsome director. Anyway, so one of the movies I watched was Eli Roth's remake of Death Wish, which was generally panned by critics. And it's Bruce Willis. And one of the actresses I love most in the world is Elizabeth Shue. I can't get enough of Elizabeth Shue. But I watched Death Wish, and so expectations. So I thought, this movie's good. This is insane. This movie's good. It's not going to get Oscar nominated.
So you'll say that Death Wish is probably the most underrated movie that you've seen in recent memory.
You have to drop most. There are so many underrated movies.
I know.
That's one I saw recently that I was like, no, this is, you guys are insane. This is fine. I thought Bullet Train was good.
Wasn't it?
I was like, I think I'm supposed to hate this movie, but I didn't. I was totally engaged. Was it stupid? Yeah. I don't care.
Oh, it was so good, though.
Yeah.
I mean, so funny in it. Like, and it just sort of kept going. Had a sort of energy. How about overrated movie? Can you say that?
Well, it's funny. This is why I didn't like being a critic. I'm going to give you an answer. But why I didn't like being a critic was because I didn't
like saying mean things about
it. I didn't like saying mean things to people who are pouring their heart into their art. And I wasn't good at it. I always felt like I was imitating what a critic would sound like.
Ooh,
like I'm supposed to.
Imposter syndrome.
It was definitely felt like an imposter doing it. And I wasn't good at it. And that comes through because you have to be authentic. If you ask me movies that move me, I mean, there are plenty. By the way, I didn't mention like Random Harvest and you know, His Girl Friday. There's so many classics that I love.
Stage Door.
Right. Stage Door is so good. And that's a super underrated movie.
Oh.
Stage Door. Right. Because it's not on. There's a great chance to see Lucille Ball.
May I also recommend that you listen to Lux Theater.
Lux Theater. Yeah. I was going to say I've been.
Neil and I have been listening to those and falling asleep to those. And Stage Door is so good. And in fact, it's with not Katharine Hepburn, but I forget who played. It's another very, very big, strong actress. And you have other people in it that were in the movie like Eve Arden. Mm, Lucille Ball never did it. But it was done in the 50s. But it tears your heart out as a movie, and yet it's so funny. And the banter
is so good.
Is so good.
Eve Arden, you get Eve Arden in your movie, and it automatically becomes not terrible. Like, it's a guarantee that just her presence in a movie. Just as a movie we just screened that Martin Scorsese got us interested in for a thing we have coming up called One Touch of Venus, where Ava Gardner plays a Greek goddess statue, and then she comes to life with Robert Walker. It's not very good. But Eve Arden's in it as the head of the department store's secretary. And she puts her glasses up like this. Her glasses like are coming down there, like coming off her temples. And I just feel like that was a choice she made. But she's funny.
Of course she made that choice.
Yeah. And by the way,
she was a comedic genius.
I would probably go with, if I had to, like one movie that will make me laugh every single time as much as it did the first time, Midnight Run. Midnight Run is the greatest.
You're mentioning so many, like, how do I say this politely? Male-driven, more testosterone-based movies. My favorite movie of all time, for a variety of reasons, and I'd like to get your opinion on it, is The Sound of Music. I've said it on the show before.
My daughter just made, like, she looks like a...
She came to life from her iPad.
Yeah, she loves Sound of Music. Sound of Music's brilliant.
But why is it brilliant for you? Because you never mentioned it.
No, because musicals tend not to reach me in the same way emotionally. When they start singing, it takes me out of the moment. So when I see a musical, I try very hard and I adjust my thinking. Like this is not quite real. This is breaking into song here. This is a bit surreal. I loved how in like Chicago that we found a reason for those songs to exist, which I thought was really.
Well, that was all wall-to-wall music, essentially, right?
Right. But
Sound of Music has a great script.
Great script. Terrific. And
well, the reason I say it's cinematic perfection is because of the music, because of the elevated sense of drama that leads us into music, because of the settings, because of the perfect casting. All of those elements together made it, to me, the greatest movie Also, another movie you didn't mention, one of mine, On the Waterfront.
So On the Waterfront, I struggle with. It's brilliant. It's such a great movie.
But cold.
No, it's emotional. And I love Eva Marie as an actress and as a person. Because Kazan named names.
Oh, boy.
And no, hold on.
Yes,
but boy,
yes.
I'll forgive anyone who did that because they're not – the people who name names aren't the real enemies unless they're like Adolf Manju. But – the enemy is the industry and the government who conspired to put people in this situation where they had to lose your career or – I get why people name names, but you have to feel bad about it afterwards.
How did the Mankiewicz's fare in that?
I have a good, couple good stories. But Kazan made On the Waterfront to say sometimes it's okay to name names. Sometimes the right thing to do is name names. And I want to say to him, hey, man, the people who you're naming threw somebody off a building. That's different than guys who went to a communist party meeting in 1936 when capitalism had failed.
But it was a metaphor nonetheless.
Yeah. Right, but it's a metaphor that that stretches the credulity of your own behavior. It was a justification, as is seen through the prism as a justification for his own behavior, makes me angry. That said, obviously, it's
very
one of the great movies of the
1950s. By the way, I can't watch anything with Raoul Dahl when I hear about his anti-Semitic kind of underpinnings. And that's what I've heard. It's an opinion.
He said him. Yeah, no, he.
And that is very difficult for me to enjoy Matilda as an example because of that reason. It's so crazy.
So it doesn't keep me from enjoying it, but it keeps me from saying that it's mentioning it as. But I just said I went off on A Face in the Crowd. That's the movie he made next, and it's brilliant, you know. And so's On the Waterfront. I love it. I've seen it many times.
Cannot help but bring in that personal.
If he hadn't written
baggage,
about why he explained himself away, like just make it and shut up.
You know what? And maybe that's the reason I actually liked it as much as I did, because maybe I did feel there was some sort of apology in that. I don't know. Maybe
I don't think he's apologized. He never apologized. And that bothered me that he never, but it doesn't matter. The movie's brilliant. He is the greatest dual threat theater director, film director who ever lived. He could do anything. Yeah.
It might be true. Mike Nichols.
I was going to say, Mike Nichols would be the other person who would come to mind quickly.
What about All About Eve? Again, I hesitate to say it might be my favorite movie of all time. That, and I also bring in Cinema Paradiso, which couldn't be more different. But the reason is there's always a personal connection that you get. Hmm. And that whole Eve Harrington climber thing is so visceral and like, I don't know. You just feel it right?
It's a juicy movie.
It's a juicy movie. So well said.
So, and it's great. And
Cinema Paradiso, aside from the love of movies and it could be the love of anything, it's that father and son connection. And I watched it again somewhat recently and it did not have the same effect.
Well, let me ask, did you watch the director's cut? Did you watch the longer version or the original theatrical cut? Because the longer version, here's an example where the director's cut does the director no favors. Like the shorter version of the movie packs a far more significant, and that's the one you would have seen
originally. That's genius.
And that's the only one I think people should see.
And I'm wondering, it probably was the latter.
Yeah.
I mean, no, the former. I mean, it probably was the director's version I saw, because why would I have seen it again?
Right.
And we brought it into the house. So
it's like 38 minutes longer and it's not as good.
God, we could talk about this forever. Let me just end with an understanding of where you're headed personally, because we need a lot more of Ben Mankiewicz. Your podcasts, I have to tell you, I watched or listened to, the Lucy version of The Plot Thickens, which made me then go into the Peter Bogdanovich first season.
Love Peter.
But the Lucy, I thought I knew everything about Lucille Ball. I revered Lucille Ball. I've met Lucy Arnaz. I've met Desi Jr. And this was so enlightening. And I loved the early years of her childhood. And you really got into her, like, essence. And no book has ever really done that. And you were amazing. And hearing you was really something. And then you went into Pam Grier, and then you went into Bonfire of the Vanities.
Bonfire of the Vanities was second, then Lucy third. You listened to them out of order, which you're allowed to do.
My question is, they're so disparate. How did you land on that? Because that connective tissue, well, there's none.
can we have a conversation, a very brief conversation? No, we have to go, about the words you just used. Because I say disparate. A lot of people say disparate. I don't know what's right. I like what I say, but I don't know who's correct.
Do you say tomato or tomato?
Tomato. Somebody says tomato.
I know. Who the hell says tomato?
I mean, I can't be friends with somebody who says tomato.
The manner born.
That's right. I just say potato.
So the question was, how do you have all these different subjects for your podcast?
Well, there's so many people to mention, but I will just say one, that that our sort of director of podcasts and the person I work with most closely on these podcasts, a woman named Angela Carone. And she's just—
I thank her at the end of every episode.
Well, TCM has blessed me with the opportunity to work with so many, and I use this is my favorite compliment to give to people. They're so competent. They're so good at what they do, and I love that. And it's such a pleasure to work with someone who knows what they're doing and has my best interest at heart, and I have hers, and we listen, we collaborate really well, and we come up with these ideas. I mean, Angela leads the way on that.
What's your next one?
Next one's going to be, I don't know if I'm supposed to say it out loud, but I'm going to anyway. So it's going to be an interesting look at John Ford.
Oh.
I have a talk podcast too, coming up with that's what I was waiting with Eli Roth, and that'll be coming up too, and that's in partnership with Max. But that's down the
that's not coming too. Turner Classic Movies?
It's a partnership between Max and Turner Classic Movies. Obviously, we're all part of the same corporate family.
A lot of my listeners of this program are very familiar with the business, and we read that we almost had the demise of Turner Classic Movies. And for the grace of God, it has survived. And it must survive. It has to survive. I support the American Cinematheque very much. And the whole mission of that organization is to keep the theatrical experience alive and well. And so Turner Classic Movies does that. And Ben Mankiewicz, you are part of that story of keeping movies alive for so many of us. I thank you.
Yeah.
For so many reasons, but I especially thank you for being my guest today.
Kevin, thank you. I want to say one quick thing before I sign off. And
please.
Say goodbye. So, you know, you started and asked about my family. And I'm so proud to be part of this family. And it used to bother me that, and my brother mentioned, I think I started this story, that when during the publicity for Mank, a reporter asked my brother and I, what's the biggest misconception about the Mankiewiczes? And Josh instantly responded correctly, that we're rich. Because there's no money. Neither of us has inherited a dollar, and we won't. Nor did my father inherit any money. Herman didn't have any money. There's some money on the other side of the family. But also the capital, it mattered. I didn't sort of think it mattered, but it mattered to be a Mankiewicz in this town, in this business. And it obviously has helped me.
How was Mank for you?
It was incredibly moving. I sobbed because it was exactly how my father described his father, who I never knew. That was it. Gary Oldman. As soon as the first I saw him, I was like, oh, that's it. And I wanted my dad to have been there to see it so badly. He would have loved it. He would have loved it. Because it did capture the spirit of Herman. Drunk, gambling, never mean except to people who you could be mean to. Louis B. Mayer, William Randolph Hearst. It's okay to be mean to them, right? But he loved his wife and he was loyal and hated him, self-loathing, you know? Mm. So anyway, I'm just proud to be in this family. I hope my daughter gets that it's worth being proud of it. And we inherited a legacy that I hope I can live up to.
Well, you have, you will, we all have confidence, and we, again, are grateful to you. To our listeners, I hope you enjoyed our interview with Ben. I encourage you to follow him on social media and, of course, check out Turner Classic Movies. Please also check out my book, Audienceology, at Amazon or through my website at kevingetz360.com. And you can also follow me on my social media at kevingetz360. Next time on Don't Kill the Messenger, I'll welcome director, screenwriter, producer, and actor Eli Roth. Until then, I'm Kevin Getz. And to you, our listeners, I appreciate you being part of the movie-making process. Your opinions matter.